if this were my business, how would I be able to make it better? So that's a place I aspire to be in most of my clients' case. And when the client gives me that leverage that you are as a partner to us, that's my ideal client. I love to work with them.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your organization spend without buying an ERP, but we are not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Neeti Chauhan, national CFO based on the west coast of the USA now, but Neeti has come a long way, both physically and also in her career. We're going to talk about how she built up a successful organization in Bangalore, India, before throwing it all away to come to the US and start all over from scratch, and how she's doing that now. So you should stay tuned if you're interested in the differences and similarities between doing business in the US and India. And also, we're going to sprinkle in a little bit of tech stack goodness for the nerds out there. We're going to talk about some of Neeti's favorite tools when it comes to making sure that you've streamlined your finance function. Neeti, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you can start things off by telling us something about you that many of your colleagues may not know.
Thank you, James. That introduction was really warm and welcoming. Things about me, there are many, but one of them that I would like to list down is I'm very good, like pretty good at doing yoga. I have been practicing yoga since more than 20 years now. So recently I am mastering the wheel pose, which is Chakrasana, and I can do I am not trying to flex myself or something, but yeah, I can manage to do a headstand as well. So yeah, I think that's something which my colleagues might not know, that I'm into this as well.
I have huge admiration for anyone who can do that. Anytime I've tried yoga, I end up just lying there thinking of my enemies and what I want to do with them, to them. And I know it's supposed to be a relaxing experience, but I just get sort of stressed out. And of course, it's not a competition, but being a guy, I'm sitting there just being terrible at it, thinking I'm the worst guy in this room. So I need to get over that. That's my own issues. But
yeah, no, it's just practice. Once you practice, you'll be there.
So what, from your experience, obviously you're quite advanced when it comes to yoga. Is there anything you've learned from your yoga practice that you get to apply in your day-to-day as a fractional CFO, or any sort of way of thinking that helps you?
Yeah, there are many things. One of the things is, yes, you practice, that you get good at things once you keep on doing them. Mm-hmm. Initially, when I started off, there were many things about SaaS, which I didn't know. But as you start working and getting into things, so you get better at them. Another would be discipline. Getting up and getting on the mat every day, it requires that some inch of discipline. And that, when you bring it to your clients, that daily I need to give something back to the client, which will be of more value to them than anything we've done so far for them. That would be something which, that's what I bring in every day, a discipline that I really want them to excel. Yeah, other than that, resilience, I can keep going.
Oh, well, okay. Well, discipline alone is it, just showing up. Consistency, I guess, in a world today where everyone is distracted and follow through is hard to find, I think. So for how long have you been doing yoga? Do you do it every day? And how many years have you been practicing?
Yeah, it's I started when I was I felt stuck in my career in my early 20s, where I felt like there's no direction to my life. That's where I started doing it, but I never left it after that. That gave direction to me, what I want. The most important thing which it gave to me is clear thinking, that this is what I want and I can go and get it. Nothing else can give. And then you progress. First I was only doing the asanas, the physical part. Then I moved on to doing meditation. Now I try to do that every day as well.
Okay, well, I almost asked an awkward question there. You started it in your early 20s and you're obviously late 20s now. So that's good few years. So we'll move on before I get in any trouble. So, okay, well, that's great. So we only invite the best of the best to be on the Gross Profit Podcast. That's what I tell people. So we better tell them how you managed to get on here. Tell us a bit about how you got qualified and how you got started with your career.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's a pleasure being here. So yeah, initially I did a Bachelor's of Commerce in India. I was based out of Mumbai. I did all my studies in Mumbai. While studying for my Bachelor of Commerce, I also studied for my Chartered Accountancy course in India, wherein I was doing that parallel to getting my degree. So I did my apprenticeship in India while completing the Chartered Accountancy course. Once I completed the course, I joined Deloitte in their audit and assurance services. And later on, I moved to Lehman Brothers. So actually, I was part of Lehman Brothers when it went bankrupt. So that was like a roller coaster ride in my career. But yeah, thankfully, it was taken over by a Japanese investment bank. The Mumbai operations were taken over by them. And then I moved to Nomura. With Nomura, I had a very fruitful career. I was sent to Hong Kong for a SOX implementation project. I worked closely with PwC, with the team from PwC over there, and we did the SOX implementation for Hong Kong entities of Nomura. And then later on in my life, I moved to a different city. I moved to Bangalore, and then I don't know what hit me, but I decided that I want to start on my own, even when I didn't know anybody or I had no connections in Bangalore. So yeah, then I started my own consulting firm in Bangalore, and it was for more than a decade. I had my firm. And then again, I'm that kind of a person who doesn't settle down for less. So then again, I threw it up all and I moved to US. So after moving to US, I worked in public accounting. I worked with them in their private equity venture capital part of audits. And then later, now I'm into consulting.
Okay, it was a lot you gave us there. I want to go back to the Lehman Brothers experience because that's such an iconic moment. We all know about it. And you were part of the transition then after the bank was sold. Tell me about that. What was it like to work in that organization at that time? Because in a way, I guess if you walk down the street and you said you work for Lehman Brothers, a lot of people wouldn't know other than to say, hey, you're the terrible bankers who whatever. Like, what was it like at the time? What was the culture like? And how did you handle the transition to the new bank?
Yeah. So, yeah, Lehman was like, I loved working at Lehman. It was like a dream job, I must say, because you get all the flexibility. The people were good and the team was really nice. And I still have those colleagues from Lehman who are still friends with me. But yeah, then, when things went wrong, initially, we were also like in a state of shock, like what's happening. And I would say there was no clear communication at that time because everything went so fast that we were also not aware like what's going to happen next. But luckily, I think the transition for India operations went smooth. We within 15 to 20 days, we had a clear understanding like, okay, there is somebody who's taking over and our jobs are secure and there's nothing to panic about.
Okay. So you were reading the newspaper to figure out what was going to happen with your job. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I must say that because, I felt the communication was, but it was just a phase, I feel. But the panic was real.
Yeah. Very good. So now I want to ask you about the consulting business you built up in Bangalore. You said you knew no one. So you moved to a new city and you had to go from zero, which is kind of what you've done twice now. So I'd like to go back to that, time, you decided you were going to burst out from the belly of the beast, as I describe it, go on your own from the safe confines of corporate life with all the accoutrements that you get with that and to go out by yourself. So you've done it before, so you know you can do it again. So, but what was how do you step out and from zero clients, not knowing anybody, to start attracting clients? First of all, we better clarify, were you doing fractional work for them or were you doing wider management consultancy work at the start?
Yeah, in India, I did a wider work for my clients. Like I was kind of a one-stop solution for them. Like Bangalore is known for its startups. So, you just have like one or two people walking into your office and telling like, I have this idea, I'm building up a company, but you know, I don't know anything about how to go about that and how to build up a team. So would you be able to help me? And that's how it starts. Like I started with like incorporating, helping them to get into incorporations, then getting all the registrations, which are business registrations, which are required. Then like whatever, like anything relating to their financial accounting, we had a team, a separate team. If I'm not signing the audits, I have a team of people, like I approach other consultants who can sign, because like I can do both. So I was in alliance with other consultants to get audited financials done, or sometimes I used to do audit myself and have the bookkeeping done by somebody else. Then, yeah, other than that, compliances, whether it be income tax or GST in India, end-to-end compliances as well. Yeah, basically, and also like not just like doing the regular bookkeeping or something, like they look up to me like as a partner, where I can tell them, oh, maybe you're spending too much on this thing, or maybe your scaling up is not that great. You need to move this direction rather than this. And that's what I valued the most for my clients, is because they did consider what I had to say and tried to implement those steps in their business.
So I think a lot of people, I had a misconception about India, I have to admit, right? So I met like 15 years ago, friends who came from Bangalore. I met them while I was living in Chile. And they just broke my mind open in the scale of the city, first of all, and the wealth that's also there, which I wasn't expecting. So like they were very successful. I'm guessing now, the guy I know now might be a billionaire. I don't know. He was into Bitcoin and back in 2011, and he's a big crypto influencer and so on. So he's done very well for himself. But he was of the attitude that, listen, if I don't do a $20 million business, I'm nothing. Like, that's it. Like, the scale of ambition is way higher than my prejudice had led me to believe it would be. And Bangalore itself seems in many ways more advanced and more certainly ambitious than a lot of European cities, let's call it, for a start. Is that your experience? Maybe tell us a bit about like what this, when you say people are starting businesses, like I know a lot of people who are starting a business, right? They have an idea or whatever, but it never really happens. But are these funded businesses, and what sort of scale were they at by the time you got involved with them?
So as I said, I got involved at an early stage, but these companies were like, because Bangalore is known for tech startups, so these companies were those building solutions for, and like I have similar clients now in US, that's where I can connect between the two. So basically, yes, AI is the big boom, and that's something which, so there were clients who used to get like funding from like other countries as well. They knew like people in other countries, and they were getting like early stage seed funding from people from other countries as well. So it was not just like, I've seen businesses scale from like 0 to 10 million easily, and like in like 3 years of time frame. So that's like there is, what can I say? There is nothing which is like a stop for most of the businesses in India. If they really have a good idea, then investors are willing to invest.
So by the time you'd built the business, you left after 10 years, I understand, and it really had become a fairly significant consultancy business relevant to that stage. Did you sell it? What did you decide to do with it at that stage?
No, I just transitioned it. I didn't want my clients to suffer because of this move which I did. So my employees and my clients were transitioned to another person without, like, I didn't want to have a burden on anyone. So yeah, it's just a transition. But yeah, luckily my employees agreed too. And that's how it was easy.
It was more important the clients were looked after well. And that was the motivation. Okay, very good.
Yeah, the staff is most important to get the work done. So in case if the employees are not agreeing, then it's not possible to do this.
So you've moved to the US now, and you've got had you already developed a specialism in SaaS, or was this something that's come with your move?
So when I moved to US, initially I did my CPA first. I got my license. I'm a licensed CPA in California. So SaaS just came to me. It didn't, like, I didn't have to work for it. Gradually, like, I am working with a consulting firm currently. And so I started with first SaaS client, but there were other clients also. But this SaaS client got me like more involved. And that's where then people thought that I'm good at this. And I started getting more SaaS clients.
Very good. All right. Well, I'm not going to pass up an opportunity for free SaaS advice on the podcast. So that's what I'm going to use it for. So I'll give you a couple of the challenges that I have running a SaaS business, which is always a little bit tricky. And sometimes there's not a right answer, but it's good to get your opinion on it. The one thing that really sort of bothers me is like, how do I know whether I'm selling at a loss? If I was selling widgets, I could buy them for X and I could sell them for X plus 3 and I'd know I'd have a gross profit, I guess. But for SaaS, it seems a lot more complicated. It's my advertising cost I have to roll in there. It's my sales team, the variable, you know, I have infinite inventory in essence. So that's the good news. But then on the bad news side is that I'm not really sure. It's hard for me to figure out financially whether my business is actually selling at a loss or not. So what's your advice to clients who are trying to figure out what their pricing is and whether they're spending too much on marketing and acquiring customers, and how do you manage that?
Yeah. So there are concepts called CAC and LTV in SaaS, where CAC means customer acquisition cost. So if your CAC and LTV means the lifetime value of the customer, if your CAC is greater than LTV, surely you're selling at a loss and you should not be doing it. The ideal rate for LTV, ideal ratio for LTV to CAC should be 3:1. That's where you know that you're running a successful SaaS business. So basically, yes, CAC is like whatever marketing spend, sales and marketing spends you are doing, you divide by the number of customers you are having and you get a CAC value. And for LTV, like it's like you do like an average revenue per customer. You multiply it by your churn rate and you multiply it by your gross margin and the number that arrives. You just compare these two numbers and you will get to know whether you are you're selling at a loss or not. But yeah, other than that, basic, like I understand that this can be complicated to calculate. One of the basic things is like for any business, if your gross margin is negative, then you're not doing, of course, you're not doing good. The ideal gross margin for a SaaS client is around 70 to 90%.
Yeah. 90%, because it's just the cost of the servers and support staff, basically, to keep the thing going, which kind of makes sense, I guess. It's always a little bit, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, can you really afford not to develop your product? If your product isn't improving, then it's dying, et cetera, but it makes sense. So in your example there, so let's say I had make it easy, I have $100 a month MRR, let's say, for an average MRR, and I have a 12-month lifetime value average. So it's $1,200 is the lifetime value of my customers. And you're saying then I should be spending, what, $200 or $300 to acquire a customer, and that can work?
Yeah. But yeah, there is more to it. I would want to know, like, assuming what will be your churn rate and what are the cost margin ratios you are looking at. Yeah, once you give me the numbers, I'll be in a better position. But yeah, overall, you can just compare the lifetime value with the CAC, and you need to be at least 2:1 or 3:1 to get there.
2:1. Okay. Yeah. All right. Very good. So, what's the sort of hardest or the nice thing about working with SaaS clients, and what's the worst thing about working with SaaS clients?
The best thing is that there are so many tools available in the market, which makes your life easier, which can help you make more strategic decisions, being as a partner for a SaaS company, as a CFO. But the worst thing is if you're not using those, because I have been handling clients who have been maintaining revenue on maintaining the ARR, the deferred revenue on Google Sheets. It just gets complicated once you scale up in business. So it's always better to have those tools which can help you make your life easy. Because if I am too stuck in just maintaining Google Sheets for you, then I will not be able to advise you like what works best and where you're going wrong and where your pricing strategies need to improve. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the tools, I mean, some of them, a Google Sheet with more than 100 rows gets out of control, right? That's the rule of thumb. So if you have a sheet with more than 100 rows, it's time to look. Now, I shouldn't complain. That's how I might make my living in life, right? So if you're more than 100 purchase orders in a sheet, then you should probably talk to us. At the same time, I'm going to complain about it because some of these tools are incredibly expensive. So, you know, we talked, one thing that I've struggled for years is just getting my revenue recognition figured out, because GAAP accounting kind of makes it a little bit tricky to see exactly who has paid you in any one particular month. And it can be you can be unclear. Have you experienced this struggle? Like, I have to accrue some of my revenue and then I have to put it on the balance sheet and I have to bring it back. And if you rub your stomach and pat your head and turn around, and the next thing you don't know where the revenue has come from. And it can be very hard to keep track of exactly who has paid for a service in any particular month.
Yeah, no, I have experienced this. And when you don't feel confident on numbers, that's the place you don't want to be. So that's something like I can relate to absolutely. So that's what my this is, that you know, if I have tools like assuming Maxio and like Salesforce is like for basic, at least your flow will be correct. You know that, you know, what your customers, how you have reached out to your customers, what your team is talking to the customers. There is a place, a resource where you can always go and look into of making better decisions for future. So Salesforce would be like really a great start for us as company. Definitely you should have that. And yes, for revenue recognition, I generally use Maxio SaaS Optics, which is like, I feel that's a good tool. It's a great tool where it's hassle-free at the end of the month when you know, like, you know, what you need to book as your ARR. There is a journal entry available. You don't have to go through each and every line of the Google Sheet, finding out like, okay, this customer did the contract end last month, or is it going to go for the next 12 months or 3 months? So that physical activity of checking how to book the revenue, that goes off with the tools. So that's where I highly recommend them.
Well, it's great, but it's super expensive, right? They charge typically in the order, and maybe anyone can, Maxio can reach out and tell me if I'm wrong, but it's in the order of 1% of revenue, top line revenue. Yeah, it can be for the software solution. So you're talking tens of thousands of dollars, even from a small installation. And I'll be honest, right? So I got the same recommendation about Maxio and SaaS Optics, and it's similar. There's other ones, there's Jumio, I think, and there's a couple of others out there. ChargeBee maybe.
Yeah.
And it's all a similar idea in that basically in order to get this revenue recognition report, you got to pay them tens of thousands of dollars every year, which seems unfair to me. And I pushed back hard about this, saying, well, listen, it's just such a simple piece of information. Is there no other way of doing it? The closest I've come across is to use like some sort of SQL query in Stripe Analytics. I think they have a report and you can kind of do it. But having heard you talk about it, maybe I have time for me to admit maybe I was wrong. Maybe it is okay. Yeah. No one likes paying this money, but it's just part of doing business.
Yeah, it's not just about the revenue entry. It's about like whenever there is a contract change, when you scale up, these things come, like if there is an early termination or early renewal, you should be able to calculate accurately what is the credit, the amount of credit which is available to the customer. These nuances, how will it impact the ARR, any change? These nuances come easily with the tool. And that's where I recommend it highly. But Stripe billing is something which, you know, it costs us less, and to smaller companies, they can use that as well.
Yeah, okay. So what are some other tools then that you like to use that help you, that you would recommend people look into?
There are many, like for P2P, there is Airbase, there is Bill.com, there is Zipalti. Those are like very common among SaaS clients. For revenue booking, I said Stripe billing or Maxio or ChargeBee. There are many, like, and for, of course, for basic accounting, you have QuickBooks, NetSuite, Sage, Xero. Those are typically used by companies. For consolidation, there are tools like Blackline, and not just like, and there is sort of like reconciliation also, like at the end of the month when you're doing the month close and you want to ensure that your books are in place. So there are tools like Blackline, Flowcast. There is a tool called GAcon, which can help you with the analytics and having a more visual presentation to your reporting. Same with Power BI. It can help with a visual presentation. Like assuming I had a client which said that I just want like a month-end summary in like one page, where, and that including like comparing with the forecast and comparing with the last month, the previous month, and forecast versus actual and what my numbers are for this month. I just want it on one page. So that's where Power BI has helped me get that. Then there are other compliance software. Like we have the sales tax compliances for a few of my clients where we are using like multiple softwares available in market like Avalara and Rock. Then for like the 1099 filings, you have Track 99.
Wow.
There are like, and I'll just name the handful. Like there is a lot available.
You know your stuff. This is, most people just pick a couple of tools. You obviously gone deep on a lot of this stuff. I should mention, we just rolled out Power BI integration for Procurement Express last week. I was working very hard on it late into the night. So anyone's listening and they want to integrate their purchasing data into Power BI, we got your back. Let me circle back. You mentioned Tipalti there. So Tipalti are kind of a enterprise grade competitor of ours, and they have lower mid-market solutions as well. Tell me about your experience with them, because I'm curious to see when it's worthwhile going for a solution like Tipalti.
Tipalti is more for like enterprise customers, which are like more than 10 million revenue, I would say, because that's below that you can use like anything like Airbase or Bill.com and you'll be okay with it. It's more of an enterprise market. It's where, the features are like, it's just that if you are scaling more in the business, Tipalti is something which can help you.
Okay, so they do purchase order management, approvals,
yes,
treat you matching, deliveries, that sort of thing. Okay, yeah, okay, but it's more like an enterprise solution, yeah. Very good, yeah, all right. Okay, let's sort of wrap it up a little bit. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about your chef's kiss perfect customer. I guess the customer base that you're building up today. You told me that you treat your companies like babies, which would be good. You take them to heart, look after them. So who's the ideal customer that should reach out to you now today?
So yes, the ideal customer is one which, you know, aligns and involves me in their strategic decisions to get to achieve like scalable and sustainable growth for the company. Because I know like sometimes accounting is treated as a back office function rather than being part of the team. And that's where the concept of like fractional CFO, I would say it came in, is because like they said, they thought that this job can be outsourced for the time. But it's not just like a back office function. When we can be part of like your pricing strategy, we can help build pricing model, help in budgeting, help in restructuring. If there is investor reporting and you need to go and give the right information to the investors, if there is spend management. So when you are looking at your accounting function, whether you have a CFO or not, the best thing to do is that involve them with the team. This is what like I personally do. Even as a fractional CFO at my client's place, I'm involved with everyone, like the growth strategist, the AE, the FE. I talk to them so that you get the pulse of the business. What's coming next is something which you get to know only when you talk to everyone in the company. So just consider us as a part of, so my that's where my go-to is. I have always been a person like thinking that if this was my business, how would I be able to make it better? But that's a place like I aspire to be in most of my clients' case. And when that client gives me that leverage that you are as a partner to us, that's my ideal client. I love to work with them.
Very good. I love that sense. You can tell that you have a little, you really take ownership of and feel part of your companies that you're working with, which is what any owner would want to hear, I guess. Now, wonderfully, as a way of getting in touch with you, you're actually on Twitter. I don't feel like anyone's on Twitter anymore. It's just me and maybe you and a couple of other people, some crazy people maybe. And I think people should reach out to you on Twitter if you're also on Twitter. You've got a wonderful banner here. It says, "You're intelligent, sweet, witty, and beautiful. A lethal combination." Who are they talking about? Was that a reply to you?
Yeah. So yeah, I do have like a good... I started Twitter in COVID. And I'm telling you, it was a fun ride until it turned X. So yeah, I know now not much people are there on Twitter, but I still love posting there. I just want to post like good stuff every day. I try to post something or the other on Twitter, but Yeah, it's been a fun ride. I'm not like more of a picture person or something, so you will not see me much on Instagram. But yeah, but I'm aspiring to be one. Yeah, let's see.
Okay, well, you can find you at CA Niti Chachuan.
Yes.
I'm going to link that up in the show notes, and then people can get you there. Also on LinkedIn, I found you on LinkedIn, so I know you're there. And yes. Yeah, thanks very much for being on the show. And thank you for listening this far. If you got this listening this far into the show, your special reward is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Well, why would you want to be on our newsletter, Niti? I'll give you some reasons, okay? So what we started doing the newsletter, we're just publishing the podcast, and you can definitely hear about the upcoming podcasts that are coming and get advice and tips and stuff. But recently, what we've started doing also is reviewing some of the worst spending mistakes that we found in the newspapers over the last week, and we started putting them in the newsletter. So a little bit of entertainment, a little bit of education. You get to hear about people who have made mistakes with their financial controls and the trouble that they've got into. And also maybe it'll give you some inspiration to make sure you don't end up in the newspapers for the wrong reason. So there's a variety of ways. There's only one way to spend money correctly. There's thousands of ways of getting it wrong. And if you get it really wrong, you can end up in trouble. So we cover articles around, you know, accounting errors that land companies in problem. We include examples of waste, fraud and abuse that get in people in court. For example, even Naomi Campbell has been in our newsletter for the inappropriate use of charitable funds that she was responsible for through a charity that she had set up. So now's your chance. procurementexpress.com/newsletter. You won't regret it. It's fun. Niti, you've been a star. Thank you very much for being on this episode of the Gross Profit Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.